Today at Reader's Corner, Randall Fuller, the author of The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. America in 1859 was a country on the verge of civil war. Abolitionist and pro-slavery forces battled it out in the nation's newspapers. Activists were advocating revolts while Southerners were talking secession. Political parties were splitting down the middle, and a little-known senator named Abraham Lincoln was just coming into prominence. Against this backdrop, Charles Darwin's pioneering work of evolutionary theory, The Origin of a Species, landed like a bomb. In The Book That Changed America, author Randall Fuller discusses the immediate and lasting effects Darwin's book had on a nation in turmoil. Covering the myriad reactions among the country's preeminent scientists, intellectuals, writers, and politicians, he reveals the ways Darwin's book influenced not only science, but the abolitionist argument, religion, literature, and the American culture. Today I'm joined by Randall Fuller, who is a professor at the University of Kansas. He has written award-winning works and has been read across the pages of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and other publications. Randall Fuller, welcome to Reader's Corner.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Randall, let's start with the basics. Mr. Darwin himself, what was he up to here? Tell us about his own evolution. He was a doctor, an explorer, eventually the godfather of evolutionary theory, and why this was such a departure from the thinking of the day.
Sure. Darwin is, just from a biographical point of view, a really interesting person because as a young man, he exhibited virtually no glimmers of the genius that he would later come to be known for. His father was constantly harping on him to be more studious, and to quit wasting his time hunting and rambling around the woods and things like that. What really triggered Darwin's evolution or his mental change was the opportunity he had as a college student to join an expeditionary adventure or voyage circumnavigating the globe on a ship called the HMS Beagle. And it was... he was in his early 20s at the time. The journey lasted 5 years. He was able to see portions of Africa and South America and places in between. And during that time, he is reading a lot of scientific works that he took with him, and he is also taking copious notes about all of the different things that he sees. And famously, what really sets him thinking when he returns after this five-year journey is a set of different finches that he has collected from the Galapagos Islands. And what he notices is that these finches each have slightly different sized beaks depending upon what island they came from. And he has this kind of eureka moment where he realizes that these finches must have all come from a common ancestor once upon a time and developed slowly to meet the different environmental circumstances of each island that they're on. So this happens in the early 1830s. And for the next 20 or so years, Darwin rather secretly and privately gathers as much information as he can about different plants and animal species and various forms of evidence for his new theory before finally presenting it to the world in 1859.
And of course, your book opens up with a dinner among, you might say, the intelligentsia of Boston. I wonder if you could help us with who was around that table and their thoughts on this book, and probably most importantly, why this work of Darwin's was such a departure from the traditional thinking of the day as to how we all got here.
Sure. First of all, I love this story about the dinner party because it shows, among other things, it shows how people with a wide variety of different interests could come together and still talk about new advances in science and new social and political concerns and things like that. None of these people were pigeonholed in one particular specialty. And to back up for just a second, the way this dinner party occurs is that Darwin sends a copy of his book to his good friend, Asa Gray, who is a botanist at Harvard University. And Gray, who is incredibly enthusiastic about this new theory, passes the book on to as many people as he can in his enthusiasm. And one person that he passes the book on to is a guy named Charles Loring Brace, who is a social reformer in New York City who is trying to help immigrant children become Americanized. And he reads Darwin's book and is equally enthused by the theory. And he has been invited to give a talk in Concord, Massachusetts on New Year's Day, 1860. And after he gives his talk, he goes to a dinner that's being held by him and hosted by the preeminent abolitionist in America, Franklin Sanborn, one of the preeminent transcendentalists in America, Bronson Alcott, and most famously, Henry David Thoreau. That gathering of four people discussed two things on the first day of 1860 as the nation is feeling itself precariously on the edge of conflict. And the first of those is Darwin's book. But related to that is the topic of slavery and abolition. In order to make sense of that and to answer your question about what is different about Darwin's theory of evolution, you need to know that the best up-to-the-minute science at that time in 1860, when it tried to make sense of how all of the world was populated with different species, had a theory called special creation. And that theory said that God had placed these different species thousands of years earlier in their environmental niche, and they had never changed or developed. This theory called special creation was eventually applied to what we would now call anthropology. That is to say, human life. And the up-to-the-minute science at the time argued that God had created different races around the world. He had placed Black people in Africa, he had placed redskin people in North and South America, he had placed white people originally in the Caucasus Mountains, this is where we get the term Caucasian, and throughout Europe. And what was pernicious about this theory is that it entailed the idea that the different races that God had created were in a hierarchical order. That is, Black people from Africa were well suited to do hard labor, this scientific theory posited, whereas white people were better at what would have been called civilization at the time. And what happens when Darwin's theory arrives in the United States, especially, is it overturns special creationism. Darwin's theory suggests that all species have been connected, just like those finches in the Galapagos. They had a common ancestor, and they developed over time into different varieties and different species, but they share a common heritage. They share what we would today consider, you know, a common genetic heritage. And for that reason, Darwin suggests, especially to Americans who are intensely involved in the question of race and slavery, Darwin suggests that Blacks and whites are not separate races that have been created differently, but are in fact brothers and sisters and related to one another.
So having said that, however, it looks as though somehow, some way, the origin of the species was co-opted and used to prove Black inferiority. Help us understand that, at this critical moment where the nation is getting ready to go to war over slavery.
Sure. One of the most prominent aspects of Darwin's theory is that it is so eloquent. And the reason that scientists, at least many scientists, embraced it at the time was because it so eloquently explained a lot of conundrums that they had, but it was so elegant that it was easily appropriated by a wide variety of social and political forces. We tend to be more familiar with the story about how Darwinism was appropriated to show that, in fact, whites are superior because they tend to dominate in at least American society, and that this proves that they are better adapted and more competitively advantaged than other races. What I found while I was working on my book is that that idea really doesn't emerge until after the Civil War, when the Emancipation Proclamation has been issued, when the 14th and 15th Amendments have been written into the Constitution, and when the South especially feels itself threatened by the possibility of black equality. The way it was initially appropriated, and again, the book comes out in 1859 and is read enthusiastically in the United States in the 1860s. The way the book is appropriated in 1860 is the way I mentioned just now, as a kind of rebuttal for this scientific racism that suggested that blacks and whites were different races.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Randall Fuller, award-winning author of The Book That Changed America. Let's talk a little bit about Henry David Thoreau and his role in this. The cast of characters you have in your book, for anyone who's been through high school or college literature classes, certainly these folks all come to light. You mentioned Alcott, and that was the father of Louisa May Alcott. What's interesting about Henry David Thoreau's role in this, again, he was the naturalist, author, poet, and abolitionist of his day, among others, of course, but he produced the first piece of literature on either side of the Atlantic that was inspired by this theory of natural selection. Tell us about that.
That's right. Thoreau is truly America's Renaissance man. In 1860, Thoreau is going outside and walking through the meadows and the forests that surround Concord for a minimum of 4 hours every day. And he's taking notes on everything he sees. He's collecting samples. He is arguably one of the most gifted botanists in the United States at that time. He is also one of the preeminent geologists at the time. And all of this is self-taught. He's doing this on his own and simply because he's interested in it. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that because of this field work that he's doing, he, more than almost anyone else in the country at the time, is more prepared to see and to test the premises of Darwin's theory in this small microenvironment surrounding Concord, Massachusetts. So there's a throwaway line in On the Origin of Species where Darwin says something like, everybody knows that in the United States, when you cut down an oak forest, a pine forest sprouts up in its place, and vice versa. And Darwin's point was that even at the level of trees, there must be a kind of competitive struggle for existence, with some trees taking over other trees in the slow unraveling of time. Thoreau reads this, and again, he's one of the first people in America to read the book and take copious notes. He reads this throwaway line, and it's as though he has a eureka moment, because he has observed the very same thing. And not only has he observed the very same thing, but he thinks he knows why that thing is happening. The common hypothesis in the United States at the time, believe it or not, is that when you cut down an oak tree, pine trees just sprout up miraculously, that not from seeds, not from anything material, but basically because God has arranged for them to pop up in that way. And Thoreau, the careful observer of nature that he is, realizes that that's not the case at all. And through careful observation, he shows that what in fact is happening is that various kinds of seeds have been adapted to thrive in various kinds of environments. And when you cut down an oak forest, for example, the pollen from pines tend to populate and spring up more quickly than the pines themselves do. And when you cut down pine forests, there have been all of these oak acorns that have been planted by squirrels that pop up. And he writes this in an essay, and in fact, it's his most popular essay, published while he's alive, and it's called The Succession of Forest Trees. And it's essentially his answer and validation of Darwinian theory, and it's published in the summer of 1860 before anybody else had written a work like that based upon Darwinian principles. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the botanist Asa Gray a couple of times in your answers. You know, we all know that the great debate of the 1860s was the Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Yes.
But there was another set of debates going on between Asa Gray and Louis Agassiz, if I'm saying that correctly.
That's correct.
The emphatic critic of Darwin. I wonder if you could give us a little background on Asa Gray's articles in the Atlantic Monthly. I guess then it was called the Atlantic. And Agassiz's position on this. I think it was about polygenics, as he called it.
That's right. Louis Agassiz, a Swiss-born zoologist, was the preeminent and best-known scientist in the United States at this time. He taught at Harvard. His closest contemporary, analog would be somebody like Carl Sagan or Neil deGrasse Tyson. He was a public scientist. Everyone knew who he was, and he was really gifted at conveying science to a large public. He was, though, also the most prominent spokesperson and theorist of what I earlier called special creationism, which was also known when applied to people as polygenism. Polygenism simply means multiple groups of human beings created in different places. Agassiz, who was the son of a minister, believed that God had placed different races of people in different spots around the globe, and that he had done so with a kind of hierarchy in mind. Asa Gray, on the other hand, is Agassiz's colleague at Harvard, a botanist, a field scientist, who has been corresponding with Darwin, and who sees that Darwin's theory answers a lot of questions that he's had from his observation. For example, he will see, let's say, many, many different varieties of lilac bushes. They all have slightly different leaves, slightly different flowers. But if you read the various works of botany at the time, each botanist kind of categorizes the different varieties in a slightly different way. And Gray realizes that there's this kind of blurring of varieties in the plant world. And Darwin's theory helps explain that to him. So Gray becomes what Darwin calls his bulldog in America. That is, he's Darwin's kind of foremost, most enthusiastic supporter in the United States. And part of his support appears in these three articles that he publishes in the summer, the late summer, early fall of 1860 in the Atlantic Monthly, in which he simply tries to explain what Darwin's theory is, what it means, why it's important, how it answers certain questions in science. The wrinkle in all this is that even though Gray and Agassiz have a big battle over Darwin's ideas, Gray himself is a very devout person. He is a born-again Christian, born-again during the Second Awakening in the United States. And he does begin to see, after his initial enthusiastic embrace of Darwinian theory, ultimately, over the course of the year 1860, begins to kind of inhabit this position that I think a lot of Americans continue to inhabit, which is an uneasy embrace of Darwin's science and yet a unwillingness to relinquish his idea that humans are special and divinely created.
I'm Bob Custra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Randall Fuller, author of the book that changed America. He discusses the immediate and lasting effects Charles Darwin's work of evolutionary theory had on a nation in turmoil. And just to give our listeners a flavor of how you're handling this in your book, and I think it's really so well done. I'm going to just quote a little passage that really you just said in so many words. Like them, the origin threatened to diminish humanity's place in the universe. It suddenly made obsolete a comforting way of looking at the world, transforming not only human history, but the way people thought of themselves in relation to God. And even Gray wasn't entirely at ease with that realization. That's really well done. But let's go from Gray to Louisa May Alcott's father, Amos Bronson, just to give our listeners, again, a flavor of some of the wacky ideas that were out there in those days. Reverse evolutionary theory. Please help us on that one.
Yeah, so Bronson Alcott is this, he's an important historical figure who from the 21st century does seem to be a true kind of flake and wacky character. He was widely considered both during his lifetime and afterwards as the most extreme transcendentalist of all the transcendentalists. And what that meant for him is that the transcendental realm, this realm above our material earth in which spirit and divinity cavorted and created, was the most important realm for him. So his response to Darwin, not surprisingly, the minute he learns of Darwin's theory, is to recoil. And Alcott, he just cannot accept a theory that is so materially based. And so in response to Darwin, he develops a kind of counter evolutionary story in which everything begins with God and works its way down. So that after God, there are angels, after angels, there are humans, and then down through the animal kingdom. So this is the theory that he posits in response to Darwin's theory, which he understands, you know, correctly as a profound threat to his transcendentalism.
We're talking here about people who call themselves scientists, Darwin included, but others like Asa Gray. What's the difference between the scientist of the 1860s and the scientist of the today? And I'm thinking of issues like proof, verification, the use of quantitative methods. How different was it then as opposed to where we are today?
Well, all of that idea of empirical truth and of weighing and measuring material reality and experimentation that we, you know, hold as sort of the hallmarks of scientific practice, that is beginning to dominate in the 1850s. And that if you go back 25 years or so, for example, Harvard doesn't really have what we would call scientists. It has natural historians and natural philosophers who are beginning to look at animals and plants in what we would consider a scientific way, but who are also looking at animals and plants as a way of trying to understand God's creation. In the 1840s and 1850s, gradually science as a kind of profession is beginning to emerge and beginning to make itself known in the premier colleges and universities. And there aren't universities at that time, but colleges in the United States. And what I found so interesting about this little sliver of time that I was looking at is that you can see the emergence of the science that we have today, but you can also see this residual culture where religious faith is the preeminent way of looking at nature. And it really hasn't been resolved which is going to win out yet. They kind of coexist uneasily in the science departments and in just the public mind of that period.
Another thought that I had, Randall, when I read your book, and I started the program out by mentioning the word intelligentsia, the folks who gathered at that dinner table at the outset of your book. And I wondered, what did the middle-class shopkeeper in Boston or up and down the coast of New England, what did they know about any of this? Was this a conversation confined to a very narrow set of elites who were educated while so many people across what was then a smaller America were not?
That's such a great question, and it's one of the sort of vexing questions that bedevils somebody who's trying to write a cultural history, because there's contradictory evidence. And what I mean by that is, on the one hand, Darwin's book was reviewed pretty extensively in the American press, especially in the newspapers. There was a habit in the 19th century with newspapers of just reprinting reviews that appeared in New York and Boston throughout the rest of the country. And as a result of that, I could find numerous reviews of Darwin's book throughout the country. On the other hand, what I couldn't find very often were journal entries from those shopkeepers that you mentioned saying, I read On the Origin of Species and it's entirely changed my world. So it's somewhat mixed. My guess is that the average newspaper reader had an idea, probably a very caricatured idea, of Darwin's theory very early on. And one way we know this is because there began to be a lot of cartoons about apes and gorillas with Darwin's name attached to it. But again, the evidence is very scant. Where I would look and where I tried to look is in available journals and letters written by everyday people in the United States. And the truth of the matter is those people had other fish to fry, whether it was their day-to-day life or their concern over the growing division in the United States about slavery.
I also wondered about the distinct place that The Origin of the Species has in the annals of history, and wondered whether or not there was anything since then that comes close to the kind of revolutionary scientific discovery it was, in the way, as you say in your subtitle of the book, ignited a nation. I mean, in 2003, we completed the Human Genome Project, and that was big news. But I wonder if maybe this wasn't bigger news.
I think it was bigger news. That for me, if you want to look for analogs of scientific discoveries or theories that so revolutionize a culture's thinking, you actually have to go backwards, and that's where you look at Galileo and Copernicus decentering the Earth and the solar system and showing that, no, the Earth is not the center of the universe, but it's in fact a planet that's circling around the sun. And Darwin's theory had a similar, you know, destabilizing and deeply disruptive effect, because it showed that eventually it showed that human beings are not, you know, the center of the universe among other species, but are in fact part of the animal kingdom and have developed or evolved as the rest of that animal kingdom has evolved. And that you know, historically has been extraordinarily disruptive to the culture. And the Human Genome Project basically confirmed Darwin's theory and hypothesis. For something similar, but certainly not a theory like Darwin's, it seems to me that our current concern and discussion with climate change also seems to show the potential for such a disruptive view of our life on the planet in a way that kind of reminds me of Darwin's theory, but somewhat differently as well.
Well, Randall, we have evolved through 30 minutes of conversation and must conclude here, but I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. I want to thank you most importantly for the book, and that is The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation, by Randall Fuller. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
Next week, historian and professor Stephanie Kuntz, author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our recent shows, you can find them on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. You can also sign up for our free podcast email on the website and download our free app for mobile devices to listen anytime, anywhere.